The Guardian.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, providing creative tools that help you bring your ideas to life. Squarespace offers free domain names, customizable designs, and 24/7 support. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer code Guardian to get 10% off.
Hello and welcome to the first Tech Weekly of 2014. Happy New Year to you all, and what a year in tech it's going to be.
CES will introduce the first smartphones in the new year, the devices that will dictate the story for all of 2014.
This year's Consumer Electronics Show kicks off in Las Vegas, and we'll be hearing from The Guardian's Samuel Gibbs from the floor about what's hot and what's hot in the world of consumer electronics. And also on the show, The Guardian tech team, Charles Arthur and Alex Hearn, gather to run through the predictions for the coming year in tech. Stay with us. This is Tech Weekly from The Guardian. First up, we head to the Den of Iniquity, where roulette tables compete for attention with Elvis-themed chapels, roller coasters, and trapeze artists.
Bringing technology from around the globe to the world's gathering place for innovation. With more than 35,000 international attendees from 150 countries, welcome to CES.
Every year, Las Vegas brings in the new one at the Consumer Electronics Show, CES, which gathers a bizarre mix of technologists, car makers, celebrities, and journalists to gaze at a techno cornucopia of goods and services from the future. Joining us down the line from the throbbing heart of the Vegas Strip is Samuel Gibbs. Samuel, are you overwhelmed yet?
Well, I'm just about holding it together, you know. I have yet to have a Michael Bay moment. He famously got up on the Samsung stage and seemed to get stage fright when his auto cue kind of bailed on him. But no, it's okay. I'm dealing with it. There's lots to do, but it's all good right now.
So describe CES for those who don't yet know it.
So International CES is effectively the world's biggest consumer electronics show, where manufacturers, big and little alike, have their goods on display to try and revitalize consumers after the blowout of Christmas. Effectively, they're bringing to the table everything that they will have on offer for 2014. And so it's basically a future-gazing show where everything from televisions to smartwatches to intelligent washing machines and even dog toys are here and being shown off in prototype to final product form. It's quite exciting.
So is this actually what's going to be coming up in 2014, or are there even further future predictions that are being showcased?
There's both. I mean, the idea of CES is really at its heart, it's a trade show for electronics retailers to see what the manufacturers have got up their sleeves for the year. But quite a lot of the manufacturers really bring prototype products with them too, to showcase what they're working on in the slightly near future and kind of gauge market reaction to concepts and ideas. So it's a good mix of really, really far off stuff and things that will turn up in February.
Who are the big players who are there this year?
Well, every year it's a battle between the biggest consumer electronics manufacturers, including Samsung, Sony, LG, and Intel's playing a big part this year. It's always a bit of a fight on the show floor for who's got the biggest stand. And so far, it looks like Samsung's the winner.
Just the idea of it being a battle to have the biggest stand on the floor. Does the biggest stand necessarily mean the best things? Does size matter?
Well, I guess you could say in marketing dollars, it certainly does. The bigger the stand, the more presence you've got at CES. But often the best things are hidden away on the tiny little booths in the back corners, the most innovative products, the things that you wouldn't necessarily see unless you really venture deep into the melee of all the tiny little booths. So, yes, size does matter a little bit, but, you know, not everything big is great.
We'll talk a little bit about some of the smaller booths in just a second, but looking at the major players who are here, what is the most futury thing that they have that they are showcasing?
Well, this year has been quite iterative in terms of like super future stuff. Actually, the biggest play so far has been the kind of smart home, Internet of Things. And probably the most iconic example of that is LG's new smart home technology called Home Chat, where you can effectively send your home a text message and it will reply with, you know, natural language questions and answer sessions. So, for instance, you could text your washing machine, "How are you doing?" And your washing machine will come back and say, "I'm partway through the spin cycle. I'll be ready in about 15 minutes. Is that okay?" You know, I mean, it's that kind of natural language interaction, which is really kind of, it's been promised for years and may actually happen in 2014.
What happens, though, if your washing machine gets snarky or starts putting X's at the end of the text messages? How do you then respond?
Oh, I think you get a bit creeped out and maybe run for the hills. When your washing machine starts answering back, you know, you're going to have to put it in its place because it's a washing machine and, you know, it's got to do its job. If it doesn't do its job...
Asimov's Laws of Robotics, right here in place at CES. That is actually quite extraordinary, but that's not necessarily something that normal people are going to have in their homes at the end of this year. Perhaps they will, but I don't really see that happening to my grandmother's house in Southern California. So what are normal people likely to see on the high street that is coming out of CES?
Well, the biggest trend at the moment is probably wearables, smart devices that can be worn on your person. And the biggest example of that is the fitness tracker. Now, you might have seen them on people out and about already, things like the Nike Fuel Band. But CES this year has shown that 2014 will be the year of the fitness gadget. I mean, there's been all sorts of things. Almost every manufacturer has launched something. LG's launched the Life Band, Sony's the Smart Band. I mean, whatever you want to track about your person, there is a gadget for it. And I think that would be the real big trend for this year. Whether that's a good thing or not, I don't know. And whether people will really buy into it, I don't know. But it's there for the offering if you fancy it.
I was in the US over Christmas and happened to go into a Best Buy, one of the big superstores that are over in the US. And I was amazed to see how many things like Fitbit or the Up Band or many, many other lifestyle fitness trackers are available on the market and are actually available to every man and woman on the street. So how do you see what you're seeing at CES translate into what people will be able to buy at, you know, at Best Buy equivalent in the UK?
Well, you'll be able to buy, like I said, you'll be able to buy basically fitness trackers for every little thing. I mean, and the beauty of it is, I think there's a downward pressure on price, so it's going to become more and more affordable. I mean, companies like Fitbug in the UK have launched a fitness tracker for just £50. The traditional price for these kind of things is around the £100 mark. And there's a big kind of movement towards using that data, the tracking your fitness and having a little bar that says you've done, I don't know, not 900 activity points and that equals 5,000 steps is all very well. But actually probing that data and seeing what you can do for your life and things like that's the big thing for this year, I think.
Well, we'll be talking a little bit more about that in the podcast. But in the meantime, still at CES, Samuel, are there any overarching changes, any trends that you're noting for this year compared with previous years?
Well, as I said before, with this kind of smart home thing and LG's kind of home chat, the one thing that stands out to me that's a big step forward for CES this year is the more natural human computer interaction. Now, Intel had a keynote specifically on this, in the fact that they said that our interactions with computers are very unnatural to humans. And they said basically that the way they want to progress is to get so you can actually have a conversation with your computer, but more so that your computer will understand what you want from your gestures, your body language, your natural human interactions. I mean, for an example, they said that the computer should be able to read what is on your face. So if you're unhappy about something, you naturally give an unhappy face, and your computer should be able to interpret that and really kind of give you more information based on your mood. I mean, for instance, if your computer does something you're not particularly happy with, a frown might correct it in the future, or a turn on a shake of the head or a nod or something like that. Those kind of things. That kind of natural interface interaction is a really big thing this year.
And have you seen anything there that kind of typifies this trend?
Well, as I said, Intel launched a new 3D camera. And we've seen 3D cameras before. It's not particularly new. But what they've done is they've integrated a camera with an IR sensor and a laser that basically gives true 3D depth perception. And it gives the computer the ability to pick you out from the background, pick out objects. It's a bit like Microsoft's Kinect, but condensed into a very tiny camera strip that can be integrated into almost any device. And that combined with a voice assistant, Intel's got Dragon voice assistant, and that allows you to basically speak and give kind of like gestures to get to the information you want very naturally. And I think that's something with Intel behind it, you're likely to see it in devices relatively soon. Possibly not this year, but towards the end of the year, because the way Intel works is it provides this these kind of technologies at a kind of like at a developmental procedure for other companies to integrate into their products, and I can see it really coming home to roost this year.
And finally, Samuel, what has been the biggest surprise headline?
Well, I have to say, other than the natural language stuff, there's no massive surprises just yet. Mostly just iterative stuff like the curved screens and wearables and the beginnings of real smart home stuff. But the biggest game-changing moment for me was MakerBot's unveiling of its digital store, basically the next generation of content for 3D printers. It sounds to me a bit like the iTunes of 3D printing, where you could effectively buy pre-made designs from MakerBot in a simple one-click fashion, and then it's a one-touch to print this thing off in your MakerBot. And they're professional designs made by the MakerBot team, and they're in collections. So you can they described it a bit like songs. The fact that you could buy one model for 99 cents, or you could buy a whole collection, like an album of them, for $9.99. And I said, well, the interesting thing here is that they're really targeting the mass market here, because it's super simple. It basically takes out the complications of 3D printing. And as long as you've got a machine capable of connecting to it, so any of the modern MakerBot machines, which aren't cheap, unfortunately. But
they're not cheap at all. I was pricing them out, actually, as a Christmas present this year. And needless to say, I did not get a MakerBot. I got a PrinterBot instead, which was, I think, $200 instead of $2,000.
Yes, the price is certainly a drawback. But I think what MakerBot's got with its current range and its new MakerBot Mini, which it launched last night, it's kind of got the beginnings of the iPod and iTunes here. And I think this is the kind of way we need to move to really push 3D printing into the mass market. Whether that's good or bad, whether people really want a 3D printer in their home and the ability to print these things, the MakerBot team definitely thinks so. They describe it as basically your one-stop shop for all sorts of things. In fact, they were explaining that the 3D printed models and things like that make excellent Christmas presents and cost you very little when you've actually got the printer. So maybe this year's Christmas is going to be full of these mini models and plastic printed things.
And also things that are printed in chocolate. I think that's a very, very important thing to remember.
Printed in chocolate. Fantastic.
Samuel, thank you so much for reporting. I know it's very early there. So enjoy the rest of your day, avoid the slots, and have a great time. We look forward to following the rest of your CES coverage on theguardian.com/technology. And finally this week, to round off our crystal ball gazing, the Tech Weekly team joins me around the table to give us their predictions for 2014. First, Alex Hearn, last year you wrote a lot about cryptocurrencies like Bitcoin, and you also wrote about underground marketplaces like the Silk Road. What is going to happen with these in the new year?
So the first caveat, of course, is that even more with most tech predictions, if I actually knew what would happen, I'd be very rich. You know, the first time I ever wrote about Bitcoin was in March last year, when one Bitcoin was worth about $30, and I called it a bubble and said people investing their life savings in it were very silly. So obviously I would like to be better in 2014 than I was in 2013.
Though in fairness, even the people who are very rich are often rubbish at predictions. They're just very rich.
Quite. They got just as lucky as I did unlucky. But with that caveat, I think my prediction for 2014 in cryptocurrencies, in things like Bitcoin and Litecoin and Dogecoin, this will be the year the actual uses of them shake out. By the end of 2014, we'll know whether or not Bitcoin is likely to be used by normal people for normal transactions, for a certain value of normal. If I have to predict, I think not. I think by the end of 2014, we'll see a few companies that have actually introduced Bitcoin support to great acclaim will actually probably quietly backtrack and remove it as they find that the expected sales boost and PR approval either never came or came in a big rush and then withered away over time. Zynga right now is the big name. They've just introduced Bitcoin transactions for their in-app purchases for all of their Farmville style games. I think it's got them some good PR. They're riding the Bitcoin boom. I find it hard to believe that come the end of 2014, your average Zynga player will be purchasing Farmville coins using Bitcoins.
I'm sorry, that is so meta. What you have just said there is so meta. That's
buying
amazing.
One fake currency with another
with
fake
another
currency.
My brain is literally melting out of my eyes right now. And actually, another
thing,
in order
to buy a fake sheep on a fake farm.
Exactly.
it's all just so crazy. But Alex, actually, I noticed today when I was looking at the Guardian site that you mentioned these other alt cryptocurrencies, I think that is what they're being called. But you also put a kind of how to create your own alt currency on the site. Can you talk me through that a little bit? Will we see, you know, my grandmother, whom I refer to all the time in this podcast, will we see my grandmother creating an alt currency this year?
It's certainly easy enough to do. I was surprised by how easy it is. For background, this is a Bitcoin developer basically built a build your own Bitcoin website for the low price of 1/100th of a Bitcoin, currently around $10. He will make you a Bitcoin. He will, in my case, stick your face on a coin, call it Herncoin, and put the program that lets people mine it and trade it up on the internet for anyone to download.
I'm going to say nothing about narcissism here. Nothing at all.
Well, I mean, mine, I'll, to put it the nice way, was a proof of concept. It was created for vanity's sake and nothing else. Another journalist, an American journalist called Joe Wiesenthal, has actually put more thought into what the world could be like if everyone had their own altcoin. He's created Stalwart Bucks, and he's actually offering one meal a month to a reader. And he's going to do an open auction every month, and the reader who spends the most Stalwart Bucks to dine with him will be taken out to a Korean barbecue in New York. These sort of use cases are plausible, but at the same time, it's hard to believe that that would be hard, that it's any easier to do it through a Bitcoin clone than it would be for him just to maintain a ledger himself. I think fundamentally, the network effects of cryptocurrencies, the fact that you want whoever you're paying to take the same currency that you have, means that there will be one currency to rule them all. Whether or not that's Bitcoin, I wouldn't like to say.
Also, we spoke briefly about the Silk Road, which was a kind of an underground dark net, or you know, whatever it is that you want to call the net that isn't easily crawled by search engines, marketplace. And you know, certainly what I've seen in a lot of the press recently is that people are moving towards these kinds of anonymous interactions, whether it's through something as ephemeral as Snapchat or other systems that just simply allow people to transact anonymously. What do you see, Alex, in the coming year with that trend as well?
Well, I'm actually surprised that there haven't been more sort of lurid tabloid-style stories about these networks. There have been paedophile rings have been broken up, which used the darknet to trade photos of child abuse. But it's all stayed rather technical. The tabloids seem to have stayed out of this. Similarly, it's a mixture of widely assumed and actually known, depending on which terrorist groups you're talking about, that software like Tor, which allows you to browse the internet anonymously, is extremely useful if you're trying to commit acts of terror. But again, we've missed the lurid tabloid element of actually linking one person's awful plans with their use of Tor. I think this year is going to be the year that those sort of stories start bubbling up, that we start linking sort of specific malicious acts with these technologies which bubbled into the consciousness last year. That's not going to be good for people who use them legitimately. There's going to be a PR war, certainly, with the people who actually need Tor, need Bitcoin, fighting the public relations image that they're going to have at the end of it all. But it's inevitable when you've got a technology like Tor, like Bitcoin.
Charles Arthur, speaking of epic battles that happen in the public sphere, what do you expect from some of the business shenanigans that are going to be going on over the next year? What can we expect from the big names in tech, and who might we see coming out of the ether whom we didn't expect?
So obviously you have the big three, as I think we could call them, the Apple, Google and Microsoft. Microsoft is going to get a new chief executive sometime this year. A lot of the short money is on Stephen Ellop, who is coming over from Nokia, the handset division, at least, which Microsoft is buying, and all the approvals have been given for that. So Nokia in Finland will be essentially a networks company, a maps company, and a sort of patent ownership company. And it's looking like they'll make some money out of monetizing their patents. There are a number of cases that Nokia is pursuing against HTC at the moment, and there's going to be some cases, I think, starting against Google and Samsung and others in the near future, where Nokia is basically, because it's out of the handset business, it doesn't have to play nice. It can start to assert its patents in a more aggressive way. Meanwhile, Microsoft will get the handset business. I'd expect that it'll wind the feature phone business down fairly quickly and focus on the smartphone business with the Lumia brand. And for Google, well, for Google, it tends all to be upside. The bigger the internet gets, the more Google gets the opportunity to have people using its services. It gets more data from people using Android phones. The shift to mobile is certainly not hurting it. And it has a number of initiatives in places like Africa, where it's offering a scheme where if people are using feature phones, if they've got internet capability, then you're able to use Google searches and click through from Google search results page to an internet destination, and Google will bear the charge. Of course, any more browsing that you then do, you have to pay for. You have to get a data plan. But you know, for Google, it's rather an effective model.
This raises something that Eric Schmidt, the chairman of Google, mentioned the other day in an interview for Bloomberg. He said that he believes that in 2014, everyone's going to have a smartphone. Obviously, they're making inroads into quite large markets, whether that's in Africa or whether that's in other areas that have feature phones. But do you imagine, do you envisage that this kind of prediction is the case?
This is classic Eric Schmidt of predicting a future and using sort of looking through the telescope and saying, wow, this thing's really close, and actually it's quite a long way away. World smartphone penetration, if you look at the world as a whole, it's about 21% or so, although in a lot of Western countries it's well past the 50% mark. There are lots of emerging markets where it's down in the teens or hovering around 20%. I would think that in the next year, you're probably going to see that world penetration increase by about 10%. But that still only leaves you with about 30% of the world using a smartphone. So he's not correct to say that you'll see smartphones used by everyone everywhere. So that's certainly one of the things. And for Apple, well, I think that Apple's going to release a larger phone this year. I think it won't be until the sort of September time when it, I suppose we're now obliged to say, traditionally releases phones, even though it's only done that for the last, 2-3 years. I think that it'll have a larger tablet at some point. Could be it's going to be doing wearables. And then with Apple, there's always the who the hell knows what they're going to do sort of aspect. Because Apple just doesn't sort of feel all the currents in the way that you think it does. I mean, when netbooks were big and everyone was saying, oh my God, Apple has to do a netbook. It was interesting, Leander Carney's book about Jonathan Ive says that they worked on designing a netbook and they just couldn't make one that they wanted to have, that they wanted to sell. So they are sort of aware of these things, but at the same time, if they don't like it enough, they just won't make it, they won't sell it. And it's quite a bizarre sort of way to operate. If you were Samsung, you'd say, well, of course you make a netbook. Who cares if it's crap? Just put it out because some people buy it. But that's not how Apple rolls.
Well, Charles, you mentioned Samsung and Apple in the same breath there. And you also mentioned patents earlier. And of course, in your article about the predictions for 2014, you said that what we saw last year in terms of patent litigation, we saw nothing. That was a quiet year. This year is going to be the big year for patents litigation.
This year is certainly going to be big. There's going to be a trial between Apple and Samsung, unless they manage to settle it ahead of time, in March in California. That's going to involve some more recent Samsung phones. It's much more about the way that the phones function. It's what's called utility patents rather than how they look, known as design patents. So all the people who said, oh yeah, well, when did Apple ever design, you know, when did they ever patent the rectangle? You guys can sort of have a rest this year because that's not going to come up. There's that. There's also Rockstar, which is the company which was set up by Apple, Microsoft, Ericsson, Sony, and BlackBerry, which bought out a whole pile of patents from Nortel, the Canadian company, $4.5 billion in August 2011. It was June of 2011. And Google have been bidding for them. Google bid $4.4 billion for the patent pile. They were bidding with Intel. Missed out on it, went on to buy Motorola because they needed a lot of patents to defend Android. Rockstar, this patents operating company, is now suing Google, Samsung, HTC, Motorola, pretty much all of the Android handset makers, and Google over a search patent, which was filed in 1997, which is before Google was even running. So I think that could be quite an interesting time. I mean, as to whether it will affect Google's operation, whether it will affect Samsung's operation, any of these companies, to some extent, it's questionable whether that will make any difference to the day-to-day operations or even the prices. But it does all have an effect on how the technology industry thinks about itself, all these patent lawsuits.
Charles, I'm glad that you clarified who Rockstar was, because my first thought was that it was Rockstar North, the company that makes GTA. And I thought, what were they doing with all of those patents? So I'm very, very glad that you confirmed that. But actually, speaking, Alex, of some of the litigation that is happening in the legal the halls of legality around the world. Some of the mundane began to creep into the future last year as 3D printing made it to the high street and online shops claimed that they were going to employ drones. In this piece that you wrote about the future in 2014, you mention a lot of legality, a lot of legal attention on some of these mundane new technologies. Talk me through that.
So here's my basic presumption about 2014, that the technologies of the next decade going up to 2025 are here already. The future is like it. 3D printing, wearable computing, drones, self-driving cars, all of these things are not finished, but it's very clear from looking at them now where they're going to improve, how they're going to get better. Over the next decade, what we're going to see is steady incremental refinements, which by definition are pretty boring to watch. You know, 2015's 3D printer will be like 2014's, but slightly faster, with a marginally better resolution, costing slightly less. Those increments add up so that the 3D printer of 2025 will be jaw-dropping. But there's not going to be any single year, and it certainly won't be this year, where we'll look at the change that's happened and be wowed. What I think will be amazing by the end of 2014 is the amount of change that will have happened in society about how we approach these technologies. Questions like, is it okay to drive while wearing Google Glass? What about going into a singles bar? What about going into a sex club? Questions like, what can you print on a 3D printer? Is piracy on a 3D printer morally equivalent to theft, or is it morally equivalent to to downloading music files? Will we see people who are of a generation where they see no problem pirating music files start to pirate physical objects? The biggest, and I think the most interesting of them all, will be the debate around self-driving cars. Again, Google, BMW, they are showing off self-driving cars which are 90% of the way there. They really can, apparently safely, drive with no human interaction on real road streets, on real roads, using nothing more than very accurate maps and extremely pixel-perfect cameras. That's going to get better. They're going to, you know, they're going to have more and more safe miles under their belt over the next decade. But this year, or maybe next year, we as a society are going to have to sit down and have debates like, if a Google car with its driver asleep at the wheel hits and kills someone, who's liable? Is it the driver? Is it the people who make the car? Is it the people who make the software? Google is going to have to come out and address these head on. And that's not going to be a conversation that they'll want to have. They'll be very happy saying, oh, well, you know, there shouldn't be accidents, or that accident rates will be reduced, or that a computer is far safer than a person ever will be. All of which are likely to be true. But a computer is far safer than a person ever will be doesn't mean that there will never be a case where someone dies. That doesn't mean that this technology shouldn't happen, but it does mean that we will need to have a conversation as a society about where blame goes, about what a fair error rate is. If a self-driving car fails 1 mile in every billion, is that safe? Is that something we're happy with? Or should we force it to be one mile in every 2 billion? These are the conversations that are going to happen this year, and they are going to be fascinating to watch.
Charles, I'd like to take this back to what we're using now. If Alex is talking about stuff we're going to be using, say, in the next 5 years, let's talk a little bit about the stuff that we use on our desks, the stuff that we take with us, and the stuff even that we wear. What is the future of domestic sort of computer-style hardware looking like in 2014?
I think that it's looking more and more like tablets of all sorts of shapes and sizes. It's interesting that this week the BBC published iPlayer stats, which showed that tablet viewing on iPlayer overtook desktop viewing for a number of days just after Christmas, which does very strongly support the idea that this was a, quote, tablet Christmas. I've also seen some data from GovUK, which suggests very much the same, that mobile and tablets are an increasing amount and more than the desktop amount in terms of viewing of sites. So what we're seeing, to some extent, we're not seeing PCs fall out of use, though I think there's people use tablets more and more, that they resort to their PCs less and less, because there's only limited number of hours in the day. But I think that because we have mobiles with us all the time, and because tablets are much easier to just pick up and use when you want to do a little bit of computing, I think that therefore you are going to see tablets continue to sell well, including in things like education and so on. And the general trend is going to be for a fall in what we could call traditional PC sales. Gartner put out some figures earlier this week suggesting that the traditional PC market, that is notebooks and desktops, are going to see another fall in 2014 in terms of sales. But you might see an increase in things like your ultra mobiles, your sort of super slim ultrabooks, or the, quote, convertibles, those things which have a detachable keyboard. But, in general, the desktop era sort of seems to be approaching some sort of twilight is a bit too strong, but it's certainly getting late in the afternoon for it. I mean, it's had a pretty good run. It's lasted all the way from, what, sort of 1980 or so. But the mobile internet is starting to take over from it, and there are going to be many more mobile internet connections by the end of this year than there are desktop internet connections.
That means interesting implications for the development of software. If you're using, for example, a mobile operating system, then it has certain shortcomings, as far as I've been able to see, using a tablet sort of as a primary work computer over something that's an operating system that's built for a more powerful machine. So how will we see that evolve? Will we see tablet and handheld operating systems become more powerful as developers start to exploit the technologies in ways that they didn't expect? Or will we simply see a kind of division, and people like me who are using my tablet for regular work are just going to have to suck it up and realize that I'm not going to get all the functionality that I would get on my laptop?
Well, I don't think Apple is going to radically change the way that iOS on the iPad works. So in that sense, people are going to have to figure out workflows, or developers are going to have to figure out ways to create workflows if they think people are shifting to using those a lot. I think that on Android, you have a little more flexibility. And when it comes to Windows 8, on the various tablets, there is possibility there for different workflows. I mean, Nokia is offering a Windows RT device, so you can do sort of office-based workflows, things around Windows apps there, which, it's got a pretty big tablet. It's quite an interesting device if what you're looking for is a sort of a desktop-style experience on the tablet. The question is whether that's trying to sort of make a shoe work as a glove or a glove work as a shoe? You know, is it actually that you should be trying to just do the work on a lightweight portable rather than a tablet? And these are the sorts of questions I think people are going to wrestle with. But, I mean, more generally, the problem that I think the PC industry is going to have is that if it's selling fewer devices, then its profitability goes down. It loses the economies of scale from making so many machines. And that's going to have an effect on how many machines it can start offering. It starts to become a vicious circle.
Charles and Alex, the last thing that I wanted to talk about was big data, which was something that many people spoke about last year in some ways as a kind of as a thing that would solve all of our problems. Throw enough data at it, crunch it around, and suddenly you have the answer to society's problems. Alex, we spoke a little bit about the social conversations that we're going to have. Charles, as somebody who has been a fierce proponent of free data and openness of data, now that it has become free, what do you think is the future?
Well, it's interesting. One of the things that Eric Schmidt talked about in his predictions, as well as, smartphones everywhere, where you go, yeah, not so much, Eric, was he said genomics, as in analyzing gene sequences, analyzing all the data that we have about DNA sequences, is going to mean huge breakthroughs in the treatment of cancer, which sort of momentarily made him sound a bit like a front page on the Daily Express. The reality is that big data and genomics is one of those areas where people say this should be really easy, we'll just throw some big computers at it. Actually, it's really difficult, and it's really difficult to follow the sense through to know whether what you're finding out is actually useful information or whether you're just following random noise in the data. And I think that's the thing with big data, is that we're still at a relatively early age in our understanding of the best ways to process it. And the companies that do it best, I think, tend not to make much noise about how successful they are, because it's actually a competitive edge. It's very much like the early days of mini computing or micro computing, when companies had a lot of success with it. They actually kept quite quiet about it because that gave them an edge in what they were doing. So I think the big data does have an effect, and all the ideas of free our data and make data more available. Actually, we still have some way to go, because the UK, for example, is suffering from lots of floods at the moment in many areas. And the Environment Agency still won't make its flood mapping data available for people to make open maps with. So, not enough free data there. And the question of quite how good we are with big data, I think, is still an open one.
Alex, how do you think that legislation will start to work? Because certainly the UK government has been embracing big data with open arms, and I'm wondering whether that will be tempered in 2014 or whether you see that as a trend that will be continuing.
I think the only way the trend will be tempered in 2014 is if the public conversation catches up to the conversation that's happening behind closed doors between law enforcement and internet companies, between the government and the national security industries. The thing that we as a people, as a civilization, have to ask is, are we comfortable with essentially setting computers to work on massive, massive data sets, drawing conclusions which cannot be argued through causally, that someone who buys a particular type of hair dye from a particular type of shop a certain number of months after walking their dog in a certain park is X percent more likely to blow up a bus? Are we happy using that sort of information to run a national security industry? Are we happy, even far, far less, are we happy handing over control of companies and purchasing decisions to this sort of seemingly random data that may just be noise from the machine? This is the promise of big data, that we can find these incredibly unlikely correlations that no one would think to look for manually. The downside is that no matter how many safeguards you put, some of these will be spurious. And if we want big data to fulfill its promise, we have to sit back and go, okay, well, yeah, sometimes we won't be able to draw a causal connection. Sometimes this will be so many degrees abstracted from the real world story that we can't see what the computer is seeing. Are we just going to trust it?
That's a difficult one to, it's a difficult judgment to call, because sometimes it might be right and then sometimes it might be wrong. We're just not sure when. Very, very interesting predictions here from the team at The Guardian on the Tech Weekly podcast. Thank you very much to Charles and to Alex. It sounds to me like this is the year that technology, that the future has arrived. We're just going to have to talk a little bit more amongst ourselves about it. For more on this and predictions from the rest of the team, head to theguardian.com/technology. Keep your eyes on that all year as our crystal ball becomes reality. Thank you to the Tech Weekly team here at Guardian Towers and to Samuel Gibbs in glamorous Las Vegas. We're back next week and for the rest of 2014 with a mix of news, interviews, and analysis from the world of technology. The producer this week was Jason Phipps. I'm Alex Krotowski, and we will see you next week.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, providing creative tools that help you bring your ideas to life. Squarespace offers free domain names, customizable designs, drag-and-drop tools, and 24/7 support. Squarespace also offers seamless e-commerce solutions for you or your small business. Every design automatically includes a unique mobile experience that matches the overall style of your website, so your content will look brilliant on any device. Start your free trial today, no credit card required. As a Guardian podcast listener, you'll get 10% off your new account by using the offer code Guardian.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.